So we continue our study this morning from the book of 2 Kings. We're in chapter 20, and we've now been studying this the last part of Hezekiah's life that we're told about in the Word of God. We've studied much about him now for many weeks, as we have several chapters in 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, also the book of Isaiah. About Hezekiah in detail. We have mention of him also in numerous books of the prophets, especially Isaiah, who was a contemporary of Hezekiah. But he's mentioned in some of the books of the minor prophets, who were also there in his day. So Hezekiah is certainly one of the most prominent examples that were given in God's Word. We have more detail about him than we do about most others in the Scriptures. So he would certainly, and I've never taken the time to try to measure the volume of information that we have about him in the Bible and compared to others. But I mean, we can just kind of run through it, and we know that. Looking at the book of Genesis and all that we have about Noah, about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, and then moving on into the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. We have so much about Moses there. We have a lot about Joshua. And then we have King David and Solomon, but Hezekiah is right up there in the midst of all of those in terms of details that God has given to us about him, and such a good example that he is. And even in this part that we're studying right now, where he fell to a temptation, this is very important for us to study and learn from. And we've tried to make note of the importance of that and why, as we're seeking to grow in Christ, and we see the example of this man that was that God was ready to take to be a servant of his for eternity, that he was spiritually prepared for that. And as he stated himself in verse 3 of 2 Kings 20, that he had walked before God in truth and with a perfect heart and done what was good in his sight, as God also testified that Hezekiah had done what was right in his sight according to what David had done in following after his father David, and that he trusted the Lord unlike any of the other kings of Judah before or after him. So he is one that God was fully ready to take, and then Hezekiah pled for his life when he was informed in his sickness that he was going to die from it. And God heard his prayer and extended his life by 15 years, did a great miracle in making the sun go backwards 10 degrees in the dial of his father Ahaz. And with that miracle was given that sign that what he had said about Hezekiah recovering and being given that 15 more years of life would be fulfilled. And of course it was. And there we have God's witness to Isaiah, the proof through that miracle and through the fulfillment of that, along with all those other prophecies that God brought to pass that he foretold through Isaiah, many of them involving Hezekiah. We have there the proof of the divine inspiration of these scriptures that we're studying here in this book and what has been revealed by God through Isaiah. So we know these are the words of God we're studying, so it's helpful to us from that standpoint also that we need to keep in mind. But then after Hezekiah recovered from his illness, and he's given that additional time. So here's a man that was formed in his heart, that God had prepared him and was as a vessel that was meet for his use for eternity. But now with additional time on this earth, rather than if God's plan had been carried out and he had died from that sickness, is there temptation in the hereafter for us. When we leave this life, are we still under temptation? No. As we know, when he tells us in Hebrews chapter 2 how Jesus was made like us in all things according to the flesh, what was it for? What is the reason that he tells us that he was made like us in all things? He suffered being tempted, and he was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin, as we know he tells us in chapter 4 in Hebrews. But that being in the flesh is what makes us subject to the temptations thereof. But when we leave this life and we're no longer in the flesh, we're no longer under temptation. Then comes the reward. We know, for example, the beggar Lazarus that we read about in Luke 16 that had much he had much suffering in this life, temptation and hardship. He overcame all of that. So then what happened when he departed from this life? He was rewarded with God's comfort in Abraham's bosom. Abraham himself was there, and we know Abraham overcame much temptation in his life. But were Abraham, and when we read Luke 16, is Abraham and Lazarus, are they under temptation there? Or are they being comforted by God for what they had overcome of their temptations while they were here in this life? And so when we go to the next life, that is our soul, does it remain in potential jeopardy when we leave this life? No. As the Lord tells us in Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this the judgment. So once we're finished with this life, what lies before us? Well, until the world ends, of course, we're in that unseen world. And if we have served the Lord, then we're in the paradise where Abraham and Lazarus and all the righteous would be. The other side of the gulf in that unseen world is that place of torment. But then when the world is brought to an end, everyone is going to be resurrected, either the resurrection of life or the resurrection of damnation. We're going to go to Judgment Day. And then we're all going to be before him there. And we're going to give account of every deed that we've done in this life and every word. And then we're going to be given our eternal sentence. And we're going to be either in heaven with the Lord or we're going to be in that lake of fire in hell, separated from him. One or the other. That's it. But once we leave this life, there's the judgment is ahead of us. But as far as temptation and whether our soul can... whether we might still be potentially in jeopardy. No, we're either going to be saved or lost at that point. So Hezekiah, if he had died at the point when God was going to take him, his soul was safe and would be for eternity. But now that he's been spared and given 15 more years of life here in the flesh... That's not 15 years free of temptation. He's still here, and that means being subject to temptation. So was there risk to the prayer, to his prayer and asking God for recovery from that illness and to have his life extended here? There was risk there, because going from where his soul was ready for eternity and would have been saved... Now he's going to be facing much more temptation for the next 15 years. And if he turns away from the Lord, then what happens to his soul? Then it's lost. There was risk there from that particular prayer. So we have to consider there, and we've mentioned some other examples of that. But when we ask the Lord for something and we're asking Him to change His plans, He may hear our prayers, but we may need to consider that what we're asking for, if the Lord changes His plans, there might be some ways that that could impact us that we're not really considering. So we need to think about that as much as we can. Is that to say that Hezekiah shouldn't have asked the Lord for additional life? I'm not saying that. I think all of us in a situation like that, then when we're sick, I mean, what's the first part of the fear of the Lord that He mentions when He teaches us that? He that will what? It's in Psalm 34 and 1 Peter 3. Love life and desire life and see many days, that he may what? See good. I mean, the very first part of the fear of the Lord that he teaches pertains to our desire to live. And if we have the fear of the Lord, do we... Now, of course, the Apostle Paul, for an example, in Philippians 1, was he in a strait betwixt two, desiring to depart and be with the Lord, but also recognizing that there was need for him to be here in this life, especially for the sake of his brethren? Were there reasons for us to be here, that God has for us to be here? Now, do we have any anticipation or hope for what is to come? And I mean, as we see more and more of the wickedness of this world, is there anything appealing at all about the thought of being free from being away from all of this vile wickedness that we see around us, and being in a place where we're surrounded only with God's faithful children and goodness and righteousness, and not be contending with these things that we are here? Well, if there's not anything appealing to us about that thought, then we got a big problem. But as we do look forward to and have hope of that which is to come, where we can be with the Lord and all of that goodness that He has in store for us, we still recognize a need to be here. And do we desire to remain? I mean, how many of us, last time whenever we were sick, were not looking forward or asking the Lord for recovery from whatever it was? We pray that for ourselves and for each other, should we? The Lord teaches us to do that. Well, the reason we want to live and survive an illness and live longer, now for us, it's not for the same reason the world does. To desire to still live is not going to put us in a special category in and of itself. But what is the distinction for a servant of God? The reason that we desire to be here, so that we can see more of His good, so that we can do that good. We want to learn more of the Lord's ways, and that we have the opportunity to grow in that goodness and righteousness and do those things. This is the opportunity to do that. That would be the reason that we should have to live. Did Hezekiah have that fear of the Lord? Was he desiring to live longer so he could have 15 more years of pleasure on this earth? Of the pleasures of the flesh? That's not what he was asking the Lord for more time to do. He loved the Lord. And he had to fear the Lord, obviously, from the Lord's description of the kind of heart that he had. And he was, he had been, I mean, who was the greatest spiritual leader that God's people had in Judah during that time? I mean, you can certainly put forward Isaiah's name there as one of the, I mean, he was a very influential prophet of the Lord. But, I mean, here was Hezekiah, their king. And did the people, I mean, how much have we read about Hezekiah leading the people back to the Lord and all of that goodness? Did he continue to desire to lead his people in the Lord's ways for more time? Obviously. But he got that time, and now with it comes temptation. And we're going to see that he falls to a temptation. We already read about what happened when, his name was exalted along with God's after the Lord turned the Assyrians away from them, and to the point where everybody knew who Hezekiah, everybody knew who Jehovah was after that, and everybody knew who King Hezekiah was. To the point that when he got sick, the news spreads everywhere, Hezekiah is sick. Whereas before, that would have very unlikely been worthy of any mention in any of these kingdoms of any distance from them. But here was the king of Babylon that hears that Hezekiah is sick, and he sends his servants with a present there. And in response, Hezekiah shows them everything in his house. And there was not anything among his treasures that he did not show them. And that was down through verse 13 in 2 Kings 20. And so then the Lord sent Isaiah the prophet to him. And we can find in the Lord's rebuke, we can see what temptation he fell to. And he fell to the temptation of pride. This was immediately after the Lord giving him that great blessing, first of all, of delivering him and Jerusalem from the Assyrians. He was given that great blessing. Furthermore, he was then given the blessing of a recovery from his illness and having his life extended by 15 years. Neither one of those are small things in terms of blessings that he was given. In 2 Chronicles chapter 32, I know that we've read that before, but in this, it's a very brief summary of what Hezekiah fell to and during that time. Verse 24 tells us, "In those days Hezekiah was sick to the death, and he prayed to the Lord, and he spake unto him, and he gave him a sign." Verse 25 says, "But Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit done unto him, for his heart was lifted up. Therefore there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem." So God was angry with Hezekiah because Hezekiah was lifted up in pride. And so it tells us in the next verse, "Notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart." So if we had any question about what he was lifted up in, that's what it was. He was lifted up in pride there. And he humbled himself for it, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. But we can see what the problem was, the temptation that he fell to. And there, that needs to get our attention. The devil was the heart of Hezekiah a heart that was full of pride at that point before this temptation came? Now, how common is that to have pride in one's heart? About as common as a problem is, isn't it? Proverbs 13:10, "Only by pride cometh contention." If we're involved in arguments or fights with anybody at all, what does that tell us about ourselves right there? What's in our hearts if there's any of that going on? There's got to be some pride there. Because if we're humble, we're not going to be involved in strife with others. That's just one way of being able to look at ourselves in the mirror and seeing that. We can ask ourselves that question: Do I have contention with others? Yeah, but it's their fault. That's the way we every way of a man is right in his own eyes, and we we can very easily try to justify ourselves and look at any contention we're involved in, and it's because we're surrounded by a bunch of whatevers that it's their fault. But what does the Lord say? If we're in contention with others, well, they may have fault too, but are we without it? We've got to have pride there to be involved in that. It is a very common problem to mankind. Humility is not. So that's why that's going to be a large part of our growth process, is to have that pride purged out of our hearts and to be formed in humility. Now, what did we see when, what was going on at the time when the Assyrians came before Jerusalem, and the messengers of the king of Assyria, they were saying, don't listen to the words of your king who tells you to trust in the Lord. If Hezekiah had been a proud man, how might he have responded to that? Would the response have been to go to the temple to the Lord and ask the Lord to hear those words and do something about it? Or when they wrote it in a letter, to go spread the letter out before the Lord there in the temple and then wait for the Lord's answer through his prophet? That shows the humility that he had. If he had been proud, I mean, that was a challenge to him. Don't listen to your king. I'm going to show him. I mean, there could have been that kind of response if he had been proud, or looking to from himself, or to try to solve the problem. If he had been lifted up in pride, would he have? Would the Lord have been his fear and dread, which is what the condition was, and God's promise through Isaiah back in Ahaz's days for that deliverance from the Assyrians? If they would have the Lord to be their fear and dread, then he would save them. But if they were trying to do it themselves, then he would not. Well, if Hezekiah had been proud, would he have been turning to the Lord for that deliverance, or would he have been looking to solve that problem himself and been confident that he could find his way out of that on his own? But we can see his humility through all of that, and the fact that then the Lord was ready to take him to eternity. I mean, a proud man is not going to be somebody that is perfect in heart and walking in the ways of David and serving the Lord and trusting in him unlike anybody else. I mean, that's a humble heart that's going to do that. So how much pride had been purged out of the heart of Hezekiah by the time we start 2 Kings chapter 20, when the Lord's ready to take him to eternity? This was a heart purged of that pride. Can the devil take a heart that's been perfected and then put something in that, back in that heart that's been purged, to where with a temptation, and put something there that someone can then fall to? Now, what is it that makes us fall to temptation? A problem in the heart. And that's why that's why he tells us, we're studying the book of James on Wednesday nights, that's why in James 3:2, he says if we are not causing others to trip, which is the word offend there, if we are not offending with our tongues, he says, then we are a complete man and able to bridle the whole body. Being complete enables us to have control over our tongues and our whole body, because that heart is purged of all evil. What evil is in there that's going to make us susceptible to temptation? See, having all that evil purged from our hearts is what equips us to where we are in the best position to resist every temptation. But does it mean that we can't fall to one? That the devil can't then put something in our hearts that's evil and then cause us to fall to a temptation from it? This is a lesson we need to learn. Another way of asking that question is, at what point spiritually can we say, okay, now I'm there, I don't have anything to be concerned about anymore. The devil can't get me now. if we ever have any such thought at all, well, that doesn't sound very humble anyway, does it? But, I mean, we need to remember the example of Hezekiah. The devil's always going to be, no matter how much we've grown, and we should be able to see progress. We should be able to see wherever we are right now. We would hope and think that we're going to be able to see as we look in the mirror what needs, where we need to make changes still. But we should also be able to recognize that where we are right now spiritually, it should be, we should be in a much better situation, that we have grown compared to when we started. We should be able to see that progress there. But wherever we are along in our race, we need to be aware of this, that the devil's still going to be trying to put things back in our hearts, even if we've been purged from it. He's going to be working to make us go the opposite direction. So the Lord's forming our hearts in righteousness, but the devil's going to be trying to put things in there to make us go backwards. I mean, that's the same point that's in Hebrews chapter 3 when he says in verse 12, "Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God." An evil heart of unbelief. Can we go from a good heart to an evil heart of unbelief? Can a heart go in reverse or backwards? Yes, that's the point. It's not our hearts are not a just some static element that's there, and we're either growing or we're not. I mean, that we should be growing in the parts of God's love. If you look at Hebrews 5, you can see that they were not growing as they should, which is why they were having the warning about the going the other way. Because if we stop seeking the Lord, is it going to affect how well or how much we're growing in the image of Christ? If we seek, we'll find. But if we're not seeking as we should, things are going to change as far as what's happening with us spiritually in our growth. And it also will then end up going the other way. If we're not careful, I mean, the devil's going to be working to put things in our heart, even if we've been purged from them. So when are we safe from the devil? Only when we've overcome and the Lord takes us, and if we're ready at that time like Hezekiah was, only then. But, I mean, as long as we're here, we're not. So that is a real important point for us to keep in mind there. And that's what the devil was doing, and he got pride into the heart of Hezekiah in this situation. And as Hezekiah had been used by the Lord to do much good in leading the people to the Lord, when after God gave that great benefit, that blessing, and that word benefit that we read there in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 and verse 25, that's a word that means treatment. So when it says he rendered not again according to the benefit done unto, to the treatment, of course it was a benefit, beneficial treatment, good treatment. The Lord had done what was good to him. It had given him great blessings, not just himself, but for all of Judah and Jerusalem. But then everybody all of these others are exalting them for it, especially Hezekiah. And there's definitely going to be an opportunity to have pride to show up in the heart there. And it got Hezekiah in that situation. And not just him, as it said there, that wrath was upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem. And it says, notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, so that the wrath of the Lord came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. Did the other people in Jerusalem get caught up in this to where they were not giving the Lord all of the glory for this? Were they Were they receiving any of man's glory for the salvation that he had given to them from the Assyrians? Yeah, there was a lot of praise and glory of men going around, and Hezekiah fell to that, and not just himself, but the rest of the Lord's people there. And so the Lord was angry with Hezekiah and with all the other people caught up in that too. Who deserved all the glory and honor and praise for that deliverance that God's people had been given them? Of course, it was the Lord. There's another warning to us. When something good is done for us, that is a point or a moment when the devil is going to be after us to return the Lord's goodness with something that's not good. When we should be rendering to him according to the good he's done to us, the devil's going to tempt us to take the Lord's blessing or blessings, and then he's going to try to get an advantage over us in that, in some way, like here he did with pride for them. But whatever it is, he's going to be trying then. So we need to be very careful that we do not fall to that. I mean, what happened as soon as the Israelites got across the Red Sea and got into the wilderness, and they got to Sinai, and Moses is up there in the mountain, and here the people loaded with all of that gold and everything that God had given them as spoil from the Egyptians after all that great deliverance there. And then what do they end up doing? We know what happened. What were they doing down there while Moses was up in the mount? And God even told him, you know what they're doing down there? What were they doing? What have they done with all that gold? They made that golden calf and they were worshiping it. We don't know what's become of this Moses. And they got Aaron to make that golden calf, and they're worshiping it as their god. I mean, how long after he's taken them out of their bondage in Egypt do they end up doing that? And so here the Lord saves Judah and Jerusalem, Hezekiah, and then furthermore saves Hezekiah's life and gives him more time. And then right there, here's the devil with temptation to receive man's praise and glory, and then to use that time that God's given Hezekiah, that extra time that he'd asked for. Now he's showing all of his treasures to the Babylonians, and it's not with, okay, here's what God has done to his people. It's no question, it's a look what I've got. And he's showing all of these things, and he's proud of it. That's the problem here. And so that's why the Lord had anger for the falling to that particular temptation. Let's go over to Isaiah chapter 39. Actually chapter 38. This tells us the same. It's an account of the same events we've been studying in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. In chapter 38, verse 1, it says, "In those days was Hezekiah sick unto death, and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came unto him and said unto him, Thus saith the Lord, Set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live." I mean, this is exactly, it's just about verbatim the account that we read in 2 Kings chapter 20. And then it says verse 2, "Then Hezekiah turned his face toward the wall and prayed unto the Lord and said, Remember now, O Lord, I beseech thee, how I have walked before thee in truth and with a perfect heart, and have done that which is good in thy sight. And Hezekiah wept sore. Then came the word of the Lord to Isaiah, saying, Go and say to Hezekiah, Thus saith the Lord, the God of David thy father, I have heard thy prayer, I have seen thy tears. Behold, I will add unto thy days 15 years. And I will deliver thee in this city out of the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city. And this shall be a sign unto thee from the Lord that the Lord will do this thing that he hath spoken. Behold, I will bring again the shadow of the degrees which has gone down in the sundial of Ahaz 10 degrees backward. So the sun returned 10 degrees by which degrees it was gone down. So there's another account of those events that we've studied. Then verse 10 or 9. Now this is something we don't have anywhere else. Verse 9 says, "The writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and was recovered of his sickness." Now this is interesting. So Hezekiah wrote something after that. Well, I mean, this was a monumental event in his life, wasn't it? And so he recorded these words, starting in verse 10. "I said in the cutting off of my days, I shall go to the gates of the grave. I am deprived of the residue of my years. I said, I shall not see the Lord, even the Lord, in the land of the living. I shall behold man no more with the inhabitants of the world. Mine age is departed and is removed from me as a shepherd's tent. I have cut off like the weaver my life. He will cut me off with pining sickness. From day even to night wilt thou make an end of me. I reckon till morning that as a lion, so will he break all my bones. From day even to night wilt thou make an end of me. Like a crane or a swallow, so did I chatter. I did mourn as a dove. Mine eyes fail with looking upward. O Lord, I am oppressed. Undertake for me. What shall I say? He hath both spoken unto me and himself hath done it. I shall go softly all my years in the bitterness of my soul. O Lord, by these things men live, and in all these things is the life of my spirit. So wilt thou recover me and make me to live. Behold, for peace I had great bitterness, but thou hast in love to my soul delivered it from the pit of corruption. For thou hast cast all my sins behind thy back. For the grave cannot praise thee, death cannot celebrate thee. They that have gone down into the pit cannot hope for thy truth. The living, he shall praise thee, as I do this day. The father to the children shall make known thy truth. The Lord was ready to save me. Therefore we will sing my songs to the stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of the Lord. For Isaiah had said, let them take a lump of figs and lay it for a plaster upon the boil, and he shall recover. Hezekiah also had said, what is the sign that I shall go up to the house of the Lord? Now, there's several things that we can learn from that writing. Well, one thing is, did Hezekiah pray only that one time when Isaiah said, you're going to set your house in order, you're going to die and not live? No, this sickness had been going on for long enough where he's referring to the suffering, the physical sufferings that he was going through with it. We don't know how many days he was ill, but Hezekiah wasn't on his sick bed just lying there in silence. He was asking the Lord to save his life even before Isaiah came. That is obvious from the words that we've read there. And so once Isaiah came with the news that he was going to die, he turned his face to the wall and he prayed. But that was praying again for the Lord to save him. And then the Lord did. But throughout this, do we see the fear of the Lord? Did he desire life and love many days that he might see good? What was his motivation for having more life? How much of in here is about so I can go... I haven't gone to Egypt yet and seen the pyramids. My bucket list, I've not even scratched off. I've got several dozen things still on my bucket list. I haven't gone skydiving yet. I haven't scuba dived. Do we find all these things in there? His list of all these things that he hasn't done in this life, and he needs more time so he can do all that. No, what everything that is mentioned there, why he didn't want to die, pertained to what? His continuing to serve the Lord. And he made mention there when he says that the grave cannot praise thee, death cannot celebrate thee, they that go down into the pit cannot hope for thy truth. And then he says, the living, he shall praise thee as I do this day. The father to the children shall make known thy truth. Now, is that a... Did he have a misunderstanding that, well, once you die, then that's the, there's no more existence? No. Was he also, was his understanding that no one in the next life can offer praise to God? No. But were there things connected with that in terms of what could be done in this life? In the way that we can serve the Lord here, that once we've left here, we can't do that anymore. Yes, there are certain things, and including growing and having the opportunity, like he says, the Father to the children shall make known thy truth, to be able to teach his children some more, or the next generation. I mean, if we're gone from this life, I mean, what more can we do for our children or their children? Is that not a concern of us all? He was thinking about that. He was thinking about aspects of his service to God and ways in which he could serve him and praise him, that if he were away from this earth, that he could not do that anymore. And that everything about his prayer to God for more time was, as we can see, was centered in that. He had the fear of the Lord, and it was, he wanted to see and do more of the Lord's good. If he'd wanted to, well, as he puts it in James chapter 4, verse 3, where he says, "You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss that you may consume it upon your lust." Was he asking for more time so he can consume it upon his own desires? No. He was seeking to do good for the Lord with the time the Lord would give him if he heard his prayer. That was what his mind was. And of course, then we get to chapter 39. It says, "At that time, Merodach-Baladan, the son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and was recovered. And Hezekiah was glad of them and showed them the house of his precious things, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious ointment and all the house of his armor and all that was found in his treasures. There was nothing in his house, not in nor in all his dominion, that Hezekiah showed them not." Now, was Hezekiah thinking about that when he was asking the Lord for to save him from that illness? Was he anticipating the king of Babylon sending those servants there and, "I need more time, Lord, so that when those Babylonians come, I can show them all my stuff"? I mean, that's not what he was thinking about. He was not anticipating that temptation there. His mind fully was set to serve the Lord with any time, extra time the Lord gave him. Yet with that extra time that the Lord gave him, with that goodness, came the temptation to not return to the Lord the good that the Lord was giving to Hezekiah by hearing his prayer. And so here was the devil putting pride there in his heart and then tempting him to do what he did. And so in verse 3 it says, "Then came Isaiah the prophet unto King Hezekiah and said unto him, What said these men, and from whence came they unto thee? And Hezekiah said, They are come from a far country unto me, even from Babylon. Then said he, What have they seen in thine house? And Hezekiah answered, All that is in thy house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them." Now, what did Hezekiah not do when Isaiah asked him those questions? Compare it to Genesis 3. Or some other times when people were confronted in a situation when they had done wrong. King Saul. When the prophet Samuel came to Saul and said, "What have you done?" Did he get an answer like this? "I've obeyed the voice of the Lord." That was the answer he got. "What meaneth then the sound of the bleating of the sheep and the lowing of the oxen in my ears?" If he'd obeyed the voice of the Lord and slaughtered all the animals like he'd been told to of the Amalekites, there would have been no mooing or bleating going on. But there was, because he had not obeyed the voice of the Lord. And there was an argument that ensued until Saul lost the argument. What do we see here? And we don't see, I mean, Adam, well, the woman that you gave me, Hezekiah is not trying to blame anybody else. He's not making excuses. He is not denying and he's not lying. What would be the point of that? I mean, he knows this is God's prophet. He's not adding sin to sin by trying to lie about what happened and deny it or make excuses and blame others. He's done it and he's humbly admitting what he said. That's why we read in 2 Chronicles, he humbled his heart before the Lord. He's being rebuked for his pride here. Now, is the Lord being gentle in the rebuke through Isaiah here? This is a very gentle rebuke. How much did it take? What kind of a rebuke did it take for Hezekiah to say, this is what I've done? With no lies, no excuses about it, and not trying to blame other people. He's accepting, he's taking the responsibility for his own wrongdoings there immediately with a gentle rebuke. He didn't force the Lord to slam him down like Saul did. Of course, Saul never repented. But Hezekiah obviously very quickly humbled himself and repented of this. Verse 5, it says, Then said Isaiah to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store until this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away. And they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then said Hezekiah to Isaiah, good is the word of the Lord which thou hast spoken. He said moreover, for there shall be peace and truth in my days. Because of Hezekiah's humility, God deferred the punishment for many years into the future. Now with that particular punishment that he promised, there were two major aspects of it that we see mentioned there. All those things. So Hezekiah shows the Babylonians all that he's got. And what does the Lord say then? What's the sentence for that? To where? Yes, the Babylonians themselves, one day they're going to take all that stuff that was in the king's house and everything that they had. Well, what ended up happening? And it was more than 100 years later. This would have been somewhere, it was about, because we're getting near 700 B.C. at this point. 605 B.C. is when the first captives were taken to Babylon, the first wave, which was of the seed royal, which was the second aspect of this. So it's almost exactly 100 years. From this promise of what God was gave as a punishment for this. Now, did God forgive Hezekiah for the sin that he committed? He did. We read Hezekiah humbled himself, and we can see the humility there. So he fell to it. Now, if he had refused to listen to the Lord, if he had been trying to lie about what he had done, if he had been trying to cover it up, make excuses, blame everybody else, and not repent in humility, and he had persisted in that pride, I mean, he would have ended up losing his soul. But that didn't happen. He fell to the temptation. It came, he fell to it, but then when the Lord sent his prophet to rebuke him for it, he humbled himself and he repented. The Lord forgave him. But does that mean, does being forgiven mean there are no consequences? Did the Lord forgive Moses in Numbers chapter 20 when he struck the rock? Yes. I mean, where would Moses be now? Where is Moses now? I mean, God forgave Moses, but was there any punishment? He couldn't go into Canaan. There was a punishment there. And that was a consequence of his sin. He was forgiven, but there was punishment. Did the Lord forgive David the sins he committed in all that matter of Bathsheba and Uriah? Yes. Were there any consequences? Did he lose the child, the first child by her? Yes. Furthermore, God said that the sword was not going to depart from his house. There was going to be division in his family the rest of his days. Did that happen? That happened. So did David have to bear consequences of those sins, even though he had repented of them and was forgiven? There were two thieves hanging on either side of Jesus, and they were crucified for thievery. Were they innocent like Jesus was, or were they being punished for sins they had committed? That's a harsh sentence for thievery. But were they guilty? Yes. Did either of them repent? Yes. And what did Jesus tell the one that repented? Today you will be with me in paradise. Did he still have to bear the consequences and punishment of the thievery that he had committed? He obviously repented of it. But did the Lord forgive him? Obviously so. But did that mean that he got to immediately fly off the cross and be healed of that? And he was no more punishment there for that? No. And we know eventually he had his legs broken and then died from that. I mean, he had a miserable death as part of his punishment. We could look at many more examples of that, where the Lord does bring consequences for sins, punishments for them, and being forgiven does not necessarily free oneself of any punishments of wrongdoings that have been committed. And here's another example with Hezekiah. So the Lord was going to punish the sin. And by taking all these things, okay, here, I gave you all this stuff, and you're going to show it all off to the Babylonians like you did this yourself? Well, then it's all going to go there to Babylon one day. I mean, that was punishment number one, and it did. Under Nebuchadnezzar, they came and took everything, didn't they? And then the other thing he said is your children. So this would be the seed royal. He's speaking specifically to Hezekiah, his descendants, because it was going to be 100 years later, but it was going to be the royal seed. The children of the royal household were going to be taken and made eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Do we know the names of three of those? I wouldn't have asked that if we didn't. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Those are three of the, they were of the seed royal. You can read about it in the book of Daniel. It starts in chapter 1, but that's who they were. And why they were there. And Daniel, so we could say four. But they were of the seed royal. That's why Nebuchadnezzar took... He didn't take the common people. He took the ones that were of the royal household and the children of them to go and train them to serve in his court. He wasn't going to have commoners serving in his court. So he took royalty there of the children to be trained. And that. So they were part of the fulfillment of that. So when we read the book of Daniel, you're reading something that connects right back here to Hezekiah 100 years before. So all that happened, and we can't have anything else happen now. We're out of time, so Lord willing, we'll look at the end of, we should be able to finish up what is left in 2 Chronicles, or 2 Kings 20 on this, and we'll be ready to start to look at the reign of Manasseh, Hezekiah's son, very soon, Lord willing, but we'll continue, if the Lord wills, next Sunday morning. Let's bow together in prayer now.